A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
This podcast exists because of the paid members at decodingtv.com. If you are enjoying our recaps and reviews of shows like Andor, The Rings of Power, House of the Dragon, and She-Hulk Attorney at Law, you can support this podcast network by going to decodingtv.com, become a paid member, get ad-free episodes, early access to episodes, exclusive bonus episodes, a lot of great stuff. Thanks to everyone at decodingtv.com for making this podcast possible.
I'm just a tourist.
Oh, apologies all round then. This used to be a 6 month sentence. 6 years.
6 years? No, wait.
But... change of guidelines.
Take him away.
I didn't do anything. Hey.
Take it up with the emperor.
Wait. I'm just a tourist.
Next.
Wait.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Decoding TV, a podcast about television. I am David Chen.
And I'm Patrick Willems.
Welcome to the podcast. On today's episode, we're going to be discussing Andor, Season 1, Episode 7, entitled Announcement. Pretty terrible episode for a terrible title for an episode, in my opinion. Not love an announcement. I know it's like, I understand the symbolic importance of it, but pretty blah generic term. What do you think, Patrick? Am I giving the show a hard time right off the bat?
I don't know. I mean, it is TV episode titles are not especially important. Usually most the casual viewers of television episodes do not even remember titles of episodes.
Yeah.
Don't even say it on screen. I mean, I think it would be improved if it were even just called an announcement.
Yes. I think putting announcement there makes me feel like something went wrong with my Disney Plus app and like they meant to put an announcement there instead of the word announcement.
Exactly.
Know? So anyway.
It does seem like they're going for the simplest possible titles with the show.
Agreed. Like, it feels like they're putting a lot less work into the titles than the show itself, which I'm okay with. If that's a place where the creativity needs to go away, then I'm okay with it being the episode titles. This is the kind of piercing insight you can expect on Decoding TV podcasts. Find more episodes of this show at podcast.decodingtv.com. Email us at decodingtv@gmail.com. And find us and follow us on TikTok, Twitter, and YouTube at Decoding TV.
And be sure to comment and give us your opinions on these episode titles.
Yes, agreed. Okay. Before we get into Season 1, Episode 7 of Andor, let's do a couple quick follow-ups from last week.
As in the part where we find out what Patrick was wrong about.
Correct.
That's
correct.
Really what this is becoming.
Well, okay, first of all, here's a topic that I don't think either of us was wrong about, but a lot of people commented about where the episode was shot and last episode was shot. We loved last episode called The Eye. And I'm going to butcher this, so I apologize, but I believe it's Kruachan or Kruachan Power Station is what the name of the power station in Loch Awe, Scotland, I believe it is.
David, I think the thing about the name of this dam is that I think it is literally impossible to pronounce without a thick Scottish accent.
Yes.
I think you have to say it something like Kruachan.
Yeah, Kruachan. Yes,
yeah,
I think that's right. Yes.
Like rolling your R's. By the way, apologies to the lovely people of Scotland for probably mispronouncing this. Scotland is a great place. I love it. And I'm not actually sure how to pronounce this.
Okay, but Kruachan Dam in Loch Awe, Scotland, apparently that is where The Eye was shot last episode of Andor. And it's like a real life place. And what's cool is you can compare the photos of the real life place with how it appears in the episode, and you can see kind of some of the digital augmentations they made. But if the physical location they shot at feels real, it's because mostly it is, and it looks amazing. So yeah,
this makes a lot of sense, because I think we were talking about this last time, how we were like, is this like an astounding feat of visual effects, because how is the geography so clear? Mm-hmm. How is this place in every shot? Because like they can't build an entire dam for this episode, and they can't do this all with CGI. So just but great
it's
location
scouting. It's seamless the way they combined it with sets and with the backgrounds of Aldani that they had to create in a computer, presumably. So really well done. Yeah. Okay. On last week's episode of the podcast, Patrick Willems remarked that perhaps this is one of the first times that synths were used in Star Wars. A couple people wrote in correcting that that is not the case. Lance wrote in, this isn't the first time we've heard synths in Star Wars scores. The most notable example is Goranson's theme for the Dark Troopers, which was fittingly very synth and digital heavy. I'm sure there's more, but that one immediately comes to mind. So synths have been used in Star Wars before, but I think, Patrick, the spirit of what you said is correct, which is that they are used quite rarely in Star Wars, right? It's often orchestral, John Williams-inspired stuff, not really heavy on synths, but they have been used before.
And even, you know, like, I've watched all of The Mandalorian, and even most of I learned a thing recently when I was in Sweden over the summer. I was talking to someone, and apparently his name is pronounced it's Ludvig Jorgensen. Mm. We're all us Americans are saying that
we're
wrong.
Just butchering names left and right on this episode. Deepest apologies.
I mean, isn't that what Americans are known for?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But his score for The Mandalorian is mostly, you know, it's very like Sergio Leone. Ennio Morricone, like Western inspired. And I had just totally forgotten that there are synths in there. But I feel like the stuff at the end of Episode 6 in Britell's music here, and especially stuff we'll get into, some of his music in the new episode, definitely sound like new sonic territory for mm-hmm. Star Wars, far from what we're used to.
Indeed. All right. Well, you can always write into us at decodingtv@gmail.com. We also enjoy the comments over at youtube.com/decodingtv. That's where we get a lot of our feedback from as well. All right, Patrick, let's dive into it. Season 1, Episode 7 of Andor. This one's entitled Announcement. As usual, Patrick, let's start with overall thoughts. What do you think of this episode?
Once again, an episode that I really liked. It's obviously, no one expected like a repeat of the suspenseful, action-filled, heist of Episode 6. Inevitably, this was going to be in like an aftermath of the heist episode.
Yeah.
But for an episode that is mostly a series of just conversations between people in rooms, I was just thinking, man, I am riveted by all of this. I'm interested in every storyline that is happening. It also, one thing that really became very clear to me in this episode in particular, I know in our last episode, I was remarking on how Cassian very much felt like, did not feel like necessarily the protagonist, just felt like a member of the team. And in this episode in particular, I feel like it became very clear that even though this show is called Andor, this is 100% an ensemble piece where, you know, the title character will have equal screen time with several other characters who have not even met him before. This was not just the episode that followed Cassian Andor on all the stuff that he was up to after the heist. This was an episode that was kind of just about how the heist impacted the galaxy and so many people across there. And I really liked it. Can I mention one thing that I learned about this
Please.
Episode? We've talked a lot on the show.
I'm never going to say no to that question, unless we're running 2+ hours long on this
True.
Podcast.
And I will really try to make sure that doesn't happen. So we've talked a lot on this show about how this season of Andor is constructed in 3-episode arcs.
Yeah.
Tony Gilroy has talked about that a lot. You know, each arc usually has like one main writer, one main director, these little like story arcs. And this episode is not part of an arc. I just shortly before our recording, I listened to this interview Tony Gilroy did back in September, around when the show was premiering on the Empire Film Podcast. And he explained in a bit more detail there. He was like, Episode 7 It's kind of a standalone little transition episode
before
the next three episode arc. And then the last two episodes
How do the numbers work out then? That doesn't make any sense. But yeah. Okay, so it's going to be one transition episode, a three episode arc, and then a two episode arc. Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, with that in mind, my overall thoughts were that it felt like a transition episode. You know, there are some flashes of really cool stuff in here and a lot to like, but I would say this is probably one of the weaker episodes of the whole bunch if taken as an individual episode, which I think we kind of have to do as we're recapping it on this podcast, Decoding TV. As a standalone episode, it's fine. It's not like amazing. There's some cool stuff in it. Certainly not bad. But it really did feel very transitionary, very, very much like it's in between big things that are happening. I do think that something that we only touched upon in our last week conversation is that the show takes a quasi big swing with Andor not becoming radicalized at the end of the heist. I think you and I thought there was at least a significant possibility that by the end of that episode, he's going to be like, okay, let's go join the rebellion now, right? Like, I mean, I don't know about you, but like, I thought it was at least possible. Oh, Nemec's dead. Like, we're going to go join the rebellion and fight on his honor or something like that. That obviously did not happen, which I was quite surprised by. You know, I did not know that he would still need radicalizing at the end of the last episode. So the show has basically exposed him to what the rebellion is like. And now it's like saying, okay, we're taking him back. He's still in it for himself. And he needs to go on this journey that we know he's going to go on to become a rebel or a captain in the Rebel Alliance.
And I will say, as we learn in this episode, not everyone in the, in quotes, rebellion is equally radicalized right now.
Yes, very true. Very true. But basically, I think I bring it up just to say that, like, we still have a lot longer in Andor's arc than I thought. And I believe the second season of Andor has already been greenlit, if I'm not mistaken. So I'm really glad at that because I just have a feeling. I mean, from everything we know, he is not going to reach the end of his journey as of the end of season one. It's not like by the end of season one, he's a rebel captain and then he's going on rebel captain adventures for season two, like, is my understanding. So I will be very upset if season two does not happen for some reason. But as far as we know, everything is full steam ahead.
I mean, it seems like, I think, has Tony Gilroy said they start shooting in November? Right. It seems like this was, like, from the get-go, like, greenlit as a two-season show.
Yeah.
Like, this was... Yeah. Kind of always going to happen. And, you know, there was like some talk on Twitter this week about how apparently Andor has like, I guess, I mean, Disney Plus doesn't release like ratings or like viewership numbers, but I guess it has like fewer like social media impressions compared to other Star Wars shows.
It's highly likely that at this point, Andor is not doing as well in terms of ratings or social media mentions as other Star Wars Disney Plus shows like The Mandalorian, right?
I guess it's shocking that a supporting character who dies in one Star Wars movie did not get the casual fans quite as excited to watch a show as Obi-Wan Kenobi.
I mean, it's certainly not shocking, Patrick, as your dripping with sarcasm comment indicates. But it is still disappointing. You know, you and I both think the show is great and more people should be watching it. And hopefully my guess is there's a lot of people that are going to wait until the end and binge the whole thing. And I actually think that might be a better way to watch it. So,
I mean, I think this is a show that, especially if you look at how it's designed and how it's structured, I think this is going to be a real word of mouth show. I think this is going to be one of those things that a lot of people will catch up on between seasons one and two, because look, I mean, honestly, the biggest problem with the audience for this show is that a lot of people were fairly justifiably like felt kind of burned or let down by other
Star Wars shows,
most Star Wars stuff for the past 5 years, and we're probably just like, oh God, and now a prequel about some guy who already died in some movie that I might not even love. Like, what's the, I mean, if it weren't for Tony Gilroy, I also might be like, what's the point of this show?
Yeah.
And so, look, I feel like we encounter every time we tweet about the show, people are just like, ugh, is it really that good? Because, like, I didn't want to watch another Star Wars show. So, look, yeah. People, we're just like, look, David, we're like, we're like the rebellion in Andor in the early stages. We're just slowly getting more and more people on. We're radicalizing them. That's it. We're radicalizing the moderates who think that, like, oh, maybe I don't know about Star Wars. Do I want to commit to another one of those? And we're saying, like, no, you do. You do. Jump on board. Like, join us. This is where you want to be.
100%. 100%.
We're heroes.
That said, Patrick, if I was going to get people on board, this is not the first episode I'd show them, is a thought that had occurred to me. Is like,
no,
this is not a particularly action-packed episode.
To be fair, I wouldn't show them episode 6, and that's the best episode, because...
I thought about showing my wife just episode 6, you know? But like, you're right. You're right. You really need the 4, 5, 6 build-up at least.
You do. And it's the same thing. Like, this episode, not... the most thrilling in the whole season, but also, like, I would not call this episode unnecessary. Yeah. I feel like
I agree completely. I agree completely. Yeah. You know what I like about this episode is, I think you and I were wondering, are we ever going to see Ferrix again? Like, are we ever going to see Cinta again? It's very possible this show was just going to leave all those characters behind. We never see them again. But what's great about a show like Andor is, it shows you the consequences of the events that have happened in previous seasons. It goes back to these worlds again, and it really makes it feel like a living, breathing world, as opposed to just like we're tourists just stopping by each planet on the way, and nothing that happens is of any consequence, right? Unlike potentially other shows we might be covering on the Decoding TV network that shall remain nameless. So anyway, let's get into the episode.
Let's
do it. Season 1, episode 7. There are 4 plot lines in this episode, basically, 4 main plot lines. And so we'll cover a couple of them. We'll take a quick break, and then we'll cover the rest of them. But let's start with Coruscant, with Karn. We're hanging out with Karn. Been a while since we've had some really Karn-heavy storylines, which I've obviously missed.
David, may I coin a term?
Please.
When we get Karn material on the show...
Yes. Yes.
You know, you could, as much as I don't usually like this word, you could call it content. I'm going to say we're getting some good Karn-tent in this episode.
Potentially, if you are a fan of the Karn storyline, you are a Karny, you know? So
yes, yes.
Karnies love the Karn-tent.
Okay, wait, David, is there official Decoding TV merchandise yet? Because I think you put, I'm a carny for that Karn tent.
For that Karn tent?
You put that on shirts, you put that on mugs. Yep. I think that is going to be a major new revenue stream for you.
You know what? Here's what I'm going to say, Patrick. Let's wait until the end to see where the Karn storyline goes, because if he like presses the button on the Death Star to murder an entire village or something like that, I'm gonna hold off on that. I mean, he's already responsible for the death of several men, several of his own men.
David, what could go wrong? He's just a budding fascist who's desperate to rise among the ranks of the Galactic Empire.
Yeah, you know, no way that plotline could go south.
Never.
It's like the people that named their children Daenerys Targaryen, you know, before season 8 of Game of Thrones. It's like,
except this is dumber because, again, he is explicitly a guy who wants to rise among the ranks of a fascist institution. He's Daenerys, at least for a very long time, it's like, oh, yeah, I don't know. She's like, you know.
She's doing cool stuff. She's rebelling against the oppressors, you know.
Right, like, she's freeing slaves. She's a feminist icon.
Yeah,
you know, like girl boss with dragons. Karn,
from the start, has been a reprehensible character, I think, is what many people think.
The thing that I love about Karn is that he sucks more than almost anyone on television right now.
Mm-hmm.
As in, he's just – he's screws up constantly. He's living with his overbearing mom. He's eating cereal with blue milk. His Uncle Harlow is having to come in and help him get a job. He's got action figures in his room, and he just really wants to, like, work in law enforcement and, like, stop these people who, you know, who disrespected the company. And he's such a loser, and I love him. Anytime Karn is on, when Karn isn't on screen, all the other characters should be asking, where's Karn?
All right. So we see Karn interact with his overbearing mom. She is not treating him particularly like an adult, further infantilizing him in the eyes of the audience. Karn learns about the attack on Aldhani via a news report. And I was wondering, I didn't know that there was like a imperial equivalent of Fox News. I didn't know if that was like a thing, you know, I just am not familiar enough with Star Wars to know like what the media landscape is in the Star Wars universe.
Well, television in their world. I learned about this from reading the Revenge of the Sith novelization, which is much better than the movie. But they mostly get news through what's called the HoloNet. As in hologram. But yeah, that's usually how news spreads in the galaxy.
Yeah. So maybe it's been depicted before. I'm not saying it hasn't. So you don't need to write in. But it was the first time I can recall seeing like a news report in the Star Wars universe. And obviously it kind of opens up all these questions of how that works and how the economy of news functions in the Star Wars universe. Maybe we'll revisit those in the future. But anyway, I just thought it was notable that they had him here via news as opposed to a friend told him about it or he was listening on the ham radio in his room or something like that.
David, what friends?
Okay. I don't think we meet Uncle Harlow in this episode. So maybe they're saving the Uncle Harlow reveal for like some stunt casting. I think that's possible later, right?
Maybe. Yeah. Or maybe we'll just never see Uncle Harlow. We'll just wonder about him.
Yeah,
for the whole show.
But anyway, he shows up at this kind of bureaucratic office, the Bureau of Standards, I believe it's called.
I love this name.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's many moments in this episode that evoke Brazil to me from different plot lines, but this is one of them. Terry Gilliam's movie Brazil, and you see kind of this massive space cubicles where everyone just kind of sits in this office that looks exactly, you know, they look like all exactly the same, like they're doing the same task, and they have an opening in fuel purity. And the idea is that they are aware of Karn's past troubles with the Empire, but they're willing to give him a chance because obviously Uncle Harlow has put in a good word for him. So this job will be an opportunity for him to work his way back up.
One thing that I thought was interesting about this episode is that it felt to me, who's like, you know, not an extreme Star Wars fan, but, you know, I have a mid-level knowledge of Star Wars stuff.
You're a middle-class Star Wars content creator, even though you don't like that term.
Exactly.
But go ahead.
Also, David, content creator, please. This episode, and this is not a criticism, but like a couple of times it made me a little bit nervous. Like we've talked before in the show about how Andor has very much avoided the kind of like Leo pointing meme, like Easter egg type cameos that we've been accustomed to from Star Wars stuff for a while.
Yeah.
And this episode, in just a few ways, at least, like, I noticed what seemed a bit more like either references or like connections or Easter eggs more so than other episodes. But they never derailed things. And sometimes when I got a little bit nervous that like it might go a bit too far with that, it pulled back. But when Karn is having his, I guess, job interview walking through the Bureau of Standards, we did see a little mouse droid. You know, one of the little ones famous from, you know, A New Hope, just like running along the floor. Then he dodges out of the way. So that little kind of thing to make people go like, oh, it's that thing. It's making the sound that it makes. So, you know, we had a couple little things like that. You know, what we'll get into later is we had another familiar droid appear.
Yeah, yeah, indeed. Good catch, Patrick. Really subtle reference, that one. The next one, I mean. Not the Masteroid is, like, fairly subtle, but anyway. Okay, so that's Karn, and the final shot of him looking at a computer screen. We are not clear what he's doing exactly, but it kind of pulls back into the sea of cubicles, and you see how dehumanizing kind of working for the Empire is. Also, a lot of Severance vibes, if you've seen the Apple TV Plus show Severance.
I have, and I also thought of it.
Yeah, the idea behind that show is the characters in that show are working on these vague numerical tasks whose provenance and purpose is not entirely clear, but ultimately you suspect it might be pointless, you know, like that kind of vibe. So anyway, that is the Karn tent for this week. Any other thoughts on the Karn stuff?
First of all, it seems like a position opens up for him in fuel purity.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, if you really had to imagine what is the most boring job in the entire galaxy you could have, I would think maybe sitting in a space cubicle working for the Bureau of Standards overseeing fuel purity.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds about as boring as you can get. But I really love the final images of this episode where we return to Karn. We see, like, his little computer screen, the green light hitting his eyes, and then he just kind of looks up, and then we just pull back in, like, a series of kind of, like, staggered, increasingly wide shots where we're getting, like, very, like, real Severance vibes there of just, like, looking down at the sea of cubicles. But he's kind of slouched in his seat a little bit, just looking up as if you can see him, like dreaming of just, like, being in a higher position than where he is. He is down at the bottom. Also, one thing I also want to mention about Karn, once again, like in the first episode, we have a reference to him getting his clothing tailored. He had the collar raised on his brown suit. So this is a guy who really does put in the effort to, you know, try to dress the part. And his mother is complaining about how, I guess his, she says, like, they're not looking for an individual, like, wearing a brown suit is going to stand out too much and, you know, make him seem like a free thinker.
Yeah. Certainly that's what you think when you see that guy.
Oh yeah.
But I am curious where the Karn tent is going, right? Like, he's clearly still obsessed with Andor. And he's probably going to try to get himself in a position where he can try to do something with Andor, but I suspect he's going to lose because Andor lives through this show, right? So he's not going to kill Andor. He's not going to imprison Andor, at least not permanently. So
unless he's the guy on the Death Star who presses the button that shoots that laser beam
Scarif.
Scarif. And kills him. Wouldn't that be?
That would be incredible. Like, imagine at the final episode of season two of Andor, flash forward like 10 years to the end of Rogue One, Karn is the one pushing the button. Amazing.
And the final line of the entire series is Karn going, "Gotcha." Hits the button. I gotta say,
Cersei, it was me. Anyway, okay, go ahead.
Tony Gilroy, there's plenty of time to add this in. Also, just hire us for season two writers.
Oh, I mean, certainly. Okay.
But I think
they're, in all seriousness, they're probably setting him up for like a more risky rise and then a even more precipitous fall than he has already had, is my guess as to where the Karn tent is going.
What I'm honestly expecting is that he's going to get linked up with Dedra Miro. And that, because she is doing her own investigation.
Yeah, yeah.
And I could see that leading to him, him being probably the most knowledgeable person about what happened there on Ferrix. And so that's my guess, that in her investigation, she'll come to him, and then he'll jump at the opportunity.
Like, yeah, he's like, one condition, get me out of fuel purity, you know?
Yep.
And well, speaking of Dedra Miro, we get a lot of scenes with the Imperial Security Bureau this week. We learn about all the steps that they're taking to retaliate against anyone that might dare go against the Empire. A tribute tax. There's going to be punishment for the use of any local custom as cover for rebel activity. Will trigger, quote, a permanent revocation of imperial tolerance, end quote. And I think Partagas says, I spoke with the Emperor last night, which I think is... It's a Partagas's boss, right?
Excuse me. This is important.
Yes.
This is very important.
Yes.
We have a new character on the show who is not a new character to Star Wars.
Yeah.
So the new guy who comes in, Colonel Wolf Ullaren.
Yeah.
Wolf Ullaren... originally appeared in A New Hope. Also, to be clear, I didn't know this until yesterday. I'm not that much of a Star Wars expert. But he... Okay, you know in A New Hope when you see Vader talking to all the Imperial people in that room with the big circular table, you know, where he like force chokes the guy? Mm-hmm. Wolf Ullaren wearing the white ISB uniform is one of the guys at that table, looking more or less like this guy, mustache, white hair and everything. But he was also apparently a fairly significant supporting character on the Clone Wars animated show, where he was a person, you know, as he was like a general in the or maybe not a general, but like he worked with Anakin Skywalker during the Clone Wars and was apparently like pretty kind of a good guy, or at least like coded as like he's on the good side. He's a good guy. And I think this is really interesting to now show him on this show where they're kind of showing how a person who seemed like honorable as part of like, you know, on the good side of a war, I guess can just like without realizing it, get absorbed into like this fascist regime and still thinking that he's still serving like the same cause that he was back then.
Yeah. Yeah.
Also, I think this is the first time we've heard Emperor Palpatine mentioned by name on the show.
Exactly. And I've always wondered like how does it organize? Like does Emperor Palpatine, like Emperor Palpatine has meetings with people. He has like regular check-ins. He has a daily stand-up, basically, Emperor Palpatine does. And and you're going to get some of the texture of that in this episode, basically.
Yeah, it's also funny to imagine him talking like that.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, here's the agenda for the daily stand-up. Like, hey, let's do the check-in with Wolf. Hey, Wolf, how's Sector 1 through 8 doing? You know, like, but anyway. Great call out, Patrick. And yeah, it seems like Wolf is like higher up on the chain than Partagas even, right?
Yeah.
So I was like, oh my gosh, we're introduced to yet another person that these people need to impress, right?
Yep. It never ends. But one thing that I think is, especially here, is worth mentioning is I remember, I think you were saying, or we were discussing in our last episode, like how big this robbery actually was. And I think, I mean, it's very clear now. It's like, okay, this is a major thing.
Yeah.
And I was looking back at some bits of episode 6, and I guess when you break it down, I think they sold, what was it, like 80 million credits, but it was the quarterly payroll for a sector.
Mm-hmm.
So like a quarter of the year, but for like multiple planets.
Right.
That is fairly significant.
Yeah. 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 And it's cool to see how these actions reverberate throughout the galaxy. Like, oh, of course, it's going to cause them to tighten that, to clamp down on these activities. And a lot of people will end up getting hurt as a result. And we see some of that in this episode as well. But we also see Dedra Miro. She is asking one of her underlings, I think called Felzonis, I believe, or something with an F.
The guy sleeping on the job.
Yeah, the guy sleeping on the job. And she wants a multi-sector data blend going back 2 years of all missing avionics, comms, navigation, and targeting equipment for all star systems, end quote, which sounds like a massive undertaking. She's the guy's like, okay, that sounds like a lot of work. And she's like, do you have a problem? Like, do I make myself clear? Blah, blah, blah. And, you know, again, I think it's so fascinating how much this show is focused on what in the business world we would call organizational behavior, the nature of these bureaucracies and how they work, and how basically corporations, I guess, you know, technically it's a governmental organization, I think, but a lot of what I'm seeing in the show mirrors what I've witnessed in corporations, you know, which is what most people I think would be familiar with, which is how, again, it always feels like there's someone else to be accountable towards up the chain. The people who are the underlings, like, you know, the amount of work kind of cascades and becomes more exponential as you go down the chain, which is what we see in this scene. But then later on, there's a scene with Partagaz giving everyone hell. He's giving everyone a hard time. And then Blevin goes public against Miro because I guess he caught wind that Miro was doing this data pull and has a big problem with it. And I love the line that Partagaz says of Supervisor Miro, "Do you mind having your integrity ventilated in public?" End quote, which shows that Partagaz may be a fascist supervisor, but he still knows how to do a good turn of phrase every now and then. You know what I'm saying?
That's a great line. Yeah, yes. I mean, the funny thing about all of this stuff is that the show genuinely does kind of have us rooting for Dedra Miro.
I know, right?
Even though what she is doing is working directly against the, like, all the good guys. She is a bad guy. And yes. Yet we're like, oh man, but I want to see her pull one over on Blevin. I want to, like, when's Dedra going to get some recognition from her boss?
I know. And in this scene, she does. And there's a few notable things about this scene. First of all, she used the Imperial Emergency Act to pull these data records, which I think is a direct reference to
the Patriot
something
Act.
Like the Patriot Act, right? Where, like, people in government use an act that was passed for one purpose to, like, abuse their power for a completely different purpose. Not too subtle of a commentary, but I appreciated that it's there. And she's trying to link the thefts in a coordinated effort. Now, here's the thing that I really appreciate about this whole scene, Patrick, is I'm going to draw a comparison to you for you, okay?
Okay.
Google messaging apps, okay? Have you heard of Google messaging apps?
Yes, I'm aware.
Google has been trying to launch messaging apps for approximately 16 years. And there's a great article over at Ars Technica called A Decade and a Half of Instability, The History of Google Messaging Apps. And here are like a bunch of Google messaging apps. Google Talk, Google Voice, Google Wave, Google Buzz, Google Spaces, Google Allo, Google Duo, YouTube Messages, Google Hangouts, Google Photo Messages, Google Chat, Google Phone Messaging, etc. Like literally all actual messaging apps Google has launched. Now, in Google, if you're at Google, I'm sure it all makes sense because you're like, oh, that person, so-and-so, Patrick's on the Google Allo team and Dave Chen's on the Google Wave team. And of course, they're like separate teams, right? But if you're a customer looking at it, it makes absolutely no GD sense. Like it doesn't, why are you organized? What does one product do that the other product doesn't? It's completely unobvious to a person looking from the outside.
Reminding me of the terrible days when running your YouTube account required using a Google Plus account.
Oh, remember that? That was
God.
Awful. That was awful. And I think there's still like remnants of that on YouTube. Like there's still like legacy
Probably.
Behavior that's a result of that. But okay, why am I bringing up Google messaging apps? Is because in this scene, Dedra Miro attacks the very notion of dividing up the galaxy or system into sectors, which is a system that Partagaz himself introduced, according to what we understand. And Miro makes a great point, which is the rebellion doesn't think of themselves as in sectors. Like they don't think of themselves in this way. We, the Empire, divide up people and we're like, hey, like Blevin's in charge of Ferrix, you know, in this sector, and Dedra is responsible for this sector. But like, that's not how the rebels are thinking. And if we are to survive, we must also not think that way. We must repudiate the sector system of thinking. And I just thought it was a very like astute commentary on how there can often be a disconnect between how a corporation or a company or a governmental body organizes itself and what actually makes sense in the real world. Anyway, I'm really liking what the show is saying about organizational behavior and bureaucracies, basically. But That is how Andor has anything to do with Google messaging apps.
I love it.
I rest my case. But yeah, there's a great scene where Partagaz basically praises Dedra Miro for, I guess, abridging civil liberties is kind of what the best way I can summarize, for abusing the Imperial Emergency Act and being like, yeah, everyone should be like Dedra Miro. Dedra Miro, come with me. Let's take a walk. And then he says, watch your back, basically, because as we already know, there's a bunch of, if you work in a, as part of a fascist, you know, organization, there's going to be some people who don't like it when you get too powerful. So any other thoughts on the Imperial security stuff before we move on, Patrick?
I'm continually amazed at how engrossed I am in something that on paper sounds so boring.
Mm-hmm.
This really sounds like the last thing any of us want from Star Wars. And I'm really enjoying all of it. To bring up that thing that I always bring up, I continue to just love the way this show looks. And so I love the all white design of like the ISB offices. And I love the walls of that meeting room that they're in. It's great. Now I'm just rambling because I don't have any big observations, just that I like this stuff. I'm very interested in how it's going. And also just this idea of that Dedra is talking about when she's saying that, like, basically the Empire's responses to the Aldani heist are exactly what, basically she's like we're playing into their hands. This is what they want us to do, to suddenly just like tighten everything to like, to crack down and raise taxes and basically, you know, do all these bad things that are going to piss off the people of the galaxy. Because as we'll learn more about in the other storylines, a big part of the idea of the Aldani heist was to kind of send like a message out to the galaxy to basically motivate the Empire.
An announcement, as it were.
Oh my God, that's the title. Oh my.
Yeah.
David
Chen,
that's why you're the best podcaster in the game.
Thanks, man. Thanks. Appreciate that.
But yeah, this is all good stuff. And, you know, nice to finally see Blevin get taken down a peg.
Yeah. And also, Dedra Miro gets the Ferrix system into her, like she's now in charge of that system now. So
right.
We'll see how that plays out.
Yep.
I think it does set up the Karn Miro collaboration, the Karn Miro collab, potentially romance, Patrick.
I was about to say, David, right here, right now, we're going to start shipping Karn and Miro. Cyril
Kiro,
and Dedra.
Marn, you know, what's the combined name? You know what I'm saying?
Kiro. I think Kiro is the way to go.
I think Marn. We're shipping Marn. Or Cyril, Deirdre, Sirdra,
Zedra,
Dyril.
Dyril. Okay. David, we have to stop before everyone stops listening to the show.
Okay. All right. Well, anyway,
in the comment section, are in via email or on Twitter, or whatever. Please let us know what you think the Cyril Karn Dedra Miro ship should be called. Because look, we're all shipping a bunch of pasty, sickly looking fascists.
All right. Before we move on, Patrick, where can people find more of your work on the internet this week if they're enjoying our scintillating conversation?
If you love hearing me talk about, I guess, semi-controversial mainstream film and TV stuff, you can watch my videos over at youtube.com/Patrick H. Willems, where my extremely long and long in the works video about the entire filmography of Zack Snyder is about to premiere.
I'm really excited about that. Check it out at youtube.com/Patrick H. Willems. And if you're enjoying Decoding TV material, you may realize that a bunch of our shows are ending, and or obviously continues through November. But we are going to be recapping several new shows, and I'm going to be announcing that within the next week. So keep it tuned into podcast.decodingtv.com for more information there.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at UH1.com.
All right, Patrick, let's get to the other storylines. Coruscant with Luthen. We're hanging out with Luthen. He's listening on the radio, hearing what's going on. Apparently, the Aldanis are getting screwed out of this situation. They are being suspected of aiding and abetting this massive theft. 134 of them, I think, was the number that was said on the radio. Luthen is listening on the radio when Mon Mothma shows up, and she seems completely shocked that Luthen has done this. And Luthen is very much like, well, you knew it was going to happen. It had to happen. I did what was necessary, that kind of thing. But Mon Mothma is, again, not happy that Luthen did this, not happy that he didn't tell her. And also that he kind of usurped her authority because she thought it was her responsibility to kind of get the money that came out of this heist. So, that's kind of what happens here.
Mon Mothma also
unhappy that people will suffer as a result of this, and that's something that's clearly very important to her, as already established. Go ahead, what are you going to say?
Exactly. So what I love about this scene is that Mon Mothma also, in this episode, multiple people call her Mon, which I think is the first time we've heard. We talked about, like, do people really?
Yeah.
She does confirm that her driver is like a plant. It's like a basically like placed there by the ISB to just keep tabs on her. And I love this scene with her and Luthen because they're talking because like the idea is she's going to exchange the gift that she got for her husband. And they're talking there, but because there's like windows on the front of Luthen's shop, the driver can see in, and so they're having to like continue to smile and look like they're having a friendly conversation while having a very intense discussion. And I love the way that they will have these things where these shots where Luthen will be turned away from the window, will be like facing the back wall and will get all serious. And then if he turns around and faces the window, a smile immediately comes on his face. And so you'll have these parts where he's facing away and like is in kind of like, I guess, other Luthen demeanor, that like non-Coruscant demeanor, where he's like, very gruff. He's like, it had to be done. There must be suffering so that the, people will understand why they have to fight back against the atrocities of the Empire. And then Mon Mothma will still be smiling and looking like she's having a happy conversation because she'll be facing the other direction. And the staging and blocking of this, I thought, was really effective. And also just the idea that they're doing all of this while being watched just adds to like the tension of the entire thing and really helps create this feeling of paranoia that everyone seems to have on Coruscant.
Yeah, good stuff.
And not to just keep going, but I had also kind of, I'm not sure if I hadn't been aware or what, but it didn't really hit me until this episode that Mon Mothma was not aware of the Aldani heist.
I think we just assumed that she was involved in it somehow, right?
But the interesting thing that this raises now is our introduction to Mon Mothma in Return of the Jedi is as one of the leaders of the Rebel Alliance, waging this galactic civil war. And it's fascinating to see her now at this point when she basically like doesn't want violence at all. It's like Luthen, who knows what happens to him by the time the original trilogy rolls around.
Right.
But he
let's take bets now. Do you think he's alive at the end of Andor the series? What do you think?
No.
Yeah,
I don't.
I think he's probably dead at the end of the series, is my guess.
Yeah, but he is clearly like a much more intense like founding member. Like he knows what has to be done. He's much closer to like, I guess,
Saw Gerrera. Right.
And and it's interesting also is like seeing the radicalization of Mon Mothma, because here it seems like she's, you know, very much seems like the like, I guess, idealistic kind of like liberal senator of being like, maybe by working by mostly obeying the rules and working within the system, we can, you know, we can change things. And I feel like she's a big arc of this series. Seems like it will be steadily like be her learning, I guess, like what kind of person she has to become to enact the change that she wants to see.
Yeah. But I think it is interesting that basically the characters that, as we saw them in Rogue One, are in a very different place, right? Andor and Mon Mothma are in a very different place in Rogue One than they are at this point in the series. By the time Rogue One happens, they know each other and like trust each other. And so that'll be interesting to see too. Like they haven't met yet, as far as I understand. Right. So in fact, Luthen has put a bounty on Cassian's head in this episode. So who knows? Maybe Andor is going to be dead by the time Rogue One happens. Who knows?
And he has a twin brother.
Also named Cassian. There is the Mon Mothma dinner party, Patrick, that I know you wanted to see. Woo!
No joke. My favorite scene of the episode.
Yes. We see like lots of aliens just hanging around, you know, doing their thing.
Costumes are so good. Fancy little aliens.
Yes. Little treats on the table look like little macaroons and like pastries and stuff like that. Like nice.
Like blue cocktails. Yes.
Dainty things you can munch on, you know?
I loved it. I loved the other stuff that was going on in the scene too, but like aesthetically.
Yes.
Fantastic.
It's really cool. So Mon Mothma meets someone named Tay, who we understand is from Chandrila, which is Mon Mothma's homeworld. And they like grew up together and are old friends.
And he is a banker.
And I really liked how this conversation unfolded, because basically she wants to trust Tay because she wants to get more money. She wants to siphon off more money for rebel purposes. And in order to do so, she needs Tay's help. But so she needs to tell Tay something, but she doesn't want to tell Tay everything because that would endanger him. But she can't tell Tay nothing. And so she needs to feel out whether he's trustworthy or not. And I love the kind of little dance that they do of like, my political opinions are a lot more firm. My political allegiances are a lot more extreme than maybe you remember, you know, like, and this is kind of like back and forth dance where they like reveal a little bit to each other, little by little. Very, very nicely done. So I don't have that much more to say about this scene, but it's a cool scene where she basically enlists Tay's help and he kind of agrees to it, although she is not she does not include him in like what's actually going on. Also important to note, she basically says, Perrin doesn't know any of this, don't trust him. Okay, smile, go.
Yeah.
So like we know that Perrin is like a threat to this whole thing.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably gonna pay. I think Leeta, her daughter, and Perrin, like one or both of them is going to endanger her whole deal, and there's probably going to be some family schism at some point in the show, right? So
I'm guessing that when we see Mon Mothma in Rogue One,
you think she's going home to Perrin and Leeta at home?
Yeah, I think she has ditched her family
for
her beliefs. Which this, I mean, the dinner party was the scene where I was like, oh, is Mon Mothma like the most interesting character on this show? Mm-hmm. Like watching this, I guess, like ballet she has to like perform, and in terms of where she and Tay, like how they move throughout this party to avoid being within earshot of other people. And the way she dances around, never saying anything explicitly, but sort of like steering the conversation in certain ways where he will reveal a bit more about like his political leanings, and to the point where she can maybe hint, allude to hers a bit more. And because she never directly says like, hey, I'm trying to fund a rebellion. She's just,
yes. You know,
and the way she explains that the Mon Mothma that everyone sees is that even her family sees is a front, that yeah. she is basically lying to all but like three people in the galaxy. And you like the amount of pressure that she, I mean, granted, you know, she wasn't on like the Aldani heist, but in a different way, she's, you know, in an equally precarious situation. And I thought this was genuinely thrilling, and it is rich, fancy people talking at a space dinner party. Also, I was happy to see the actor Ben Miles, who plays Tay Colma.
Yeah.
Haven't seen him. I don't know. Last I remember seeing him in Speed Racer as one of the commentators. Yeah, a fun guy.
All right. A few other things happen in Coruscant. We see Clea, Luthen's confidant, associate, whatever, mysteriously skulking around the city. So she's kind of dressed in red, and then she meets another mysterious woman who is blonde. It took me like a good 30 seconds to realize that was Vel, because Vel is dressed completely different. Her hair is done completely different.
Vel's looking great.
Yeah. She's obviously on Coruscant and not on Aldani anymore. And they basically say, hey, I think Luthen was hoping Cassian Andor would join them, right? And the idea is that if he joined them, great. But because Cassian Andor did not join them, he is now a loose end and needs to be taken out. And they have assigned Vel to do the assassinating. So I am really, I really like Vel. I hope like nothing bad happens to her. But we know that Cassian survives. So I hope Vel survives as well. We'll see.
I know. So I've mentioned before on the show, I just love seeing more views of Coruscant. I love the design of it. So this sequence where we're mostly just like watching Clea walk through like walkways and hallways and all these things, I'm just like, great. I love seeing more of Coruscant. Also, a big thing that I learned from this episode is that if you want to be sneaky in Star Wars world, you really got to wear a big hood. Because we see Clea doing it, we see Cassian doing it,
yeah.
back on Ferrix.
Not only do you, if you want to be sneaky, Patrick, if you want to travel through Imperial controlled places completely undetected, you know,
a big hood.
This is how you do it.
That's all you need.
That's all you need. We do get a couple of glimpses of Cinta. Cinta's alive. There was a big debate between us about whether Cinta would survive, but we see Cinta get on speeder basically and like ride away, and it's unclear where she's going exactly, but she's doing what she was told, quote unquote. So Cinta's still alive. That's lovely to see. It was an open question.
Pretty impressive considering that it seems like they're cracking down on the Aldani people. And I don't know how. Also, we saw her on this cool kind of rickety speeder. It's not as slick as a speeder bike. I mean, I'm guessing that they wouldn't show her in that little scene there if we're not going to see more of her as the show goes on.
Yeah. Andor returns to Ferrix. I really enjoyed this stuff because it's just cool to like visit, you know, these characters again after I didn't know if we'd ever see them again. Only like a week or two has passed since the time we last saw them. But it's cool that we see what the consequences of Andor's actions are. I mean, he is persona non grata in his hometown, right? He killed two corpos, then went home to flee. And now he has done this heist that is the toast of the galaxy, and he is back home again. Now, no one knows that he's responsible for that heist, but he's still drawing a lot of heat. He visits Marva at their home, learns that Tim Carlo turned him in, and was really pissed about that. Now, I don't know about you, Patrick, but I thought for sure the way they were filming B2 EMO, that they had installed some kind of spyware on their robot, and because they were filming it from the robot's perspective, shallow depth of field. And I was like, why is it like the robot's like spying on them, was like the visual language of the show. So I thought the robot was going to like turn them in or something like that. And that's what I was thinking might happen, but that's not what ends up happening.
I mean, I hadn't even considered that. I would just thought, because like, you know, B2 Emo was like his little friend. And
there was like at least three or four shots that were like from B2 Emo's perspective, like looking at Andor and Marva talking, like kind of sketchily, in my opinion. And he had like this red light on him too. I was like, is he going to turn them in? You know, because that would be very, because the thing is, Andor comes home. He's like, hey, we're going to flee. Let's go, Marva. Everything's going to be great. And so, you know, something's going to go terribly wrong, right? Because like, that's not just not going to happen the way, this is not the kind of story they're telling. But I was surprised at what went wrong. It wasn't B2 Emo turning them in. It was Marva deciding she didn't want to go. There is a scene with Andor and Bix where Andor tries to get more information about what exactly went down. And he gives Bix 12,000 credits to give to all the people that he owes money to. This is probably the last time they're ever going to see each other, is my guess. Same thing for Andor and Marva as well. But any thoughts about these kind of Ferrix scenes, Patrick?
Yeah, I mean, I know we've discussed, like, will we see Ferrix again? And we did see it when the Empire was coming in and, like, you know, just setting up shop there. But I thought what was interesting about it is that, like, we're used to, okay, going back to, like, to A New Hope, the very first Star Wars movie, we're used to these things of, like, you know, seeing stories where people like Luke Skywalker, they'll get snatched away on an adventure, and then they'll be like, cool, peace out, never gonna go home again. I'm done forever. I have my cool new life. And I felt like it was really realistic to have this thing where it's like, no, he's gonna stop back and like see the people that he knows and like, you know, go home for a little bit. Like it would have been kind of strange if he just never went back to like see his, you know, like adoptive mother. Like this, him going back felt like a really natural, like believable choice for that character. And I know you were mentioning at the beginning of the episode that I guess like how he has not been radicalized yet. He is how it's going to take a while to see that journey. And what I liked about this is that his actions have radicalized Marva, and yet she doesn't know it was him, and it has not radicalized him. Like, she wants to stay because she's like, look, people sent a message that like we can actually like resist. That they can't just, the Empire can't just like keep us down forever. And he has, despite doing this, despite inspiring her, he has not grasped that yet. But what I thought was really important here was this little flashback when he's sneaking around with his big hood. Yep. And he's like hides around a corner, when some stormtroopers go by. And then we have this flashback to when he's younger and he's there with Clem, his adoptive father. And we see back then, not stormtroopers, they still had clone troopers back then, which I'm used to only seeing in CGI. It was fun to see people wearing actual clone trooper costumes. But we see how we've heard mention before of Clem being hanged. And it seems like this might be what caused it. And what led to, it seems like, Clem being executed was not him resisting and fighting back against the Empire. It was other people throwing rocks at these Imperial officers and him trying to stop them to protect them and then getting like caught as if and being accused of being one of these people resisting. And so like right there, you see like, oh, this is basically where Cassian got this idea of just like staying out of it, because his adoptive father not even through his own act, just like was simply accused.
He was in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Right. Like people just like he was not actually fighting back and people still thought that he was and he was still killed for it. So right there, I'm just like, oh, yeah, I get why Cassian just wants to stay out of all of this stuff. And I really like that touch in the scene with him and Marva of her saying that she like that street that presumably Cassian was on, which is what like reminded him of this, that she has just avoided walking down that street for years to avoid being reminded of what happened there. But now, because just like being so inspired by the Aldani thing, that she's now actually like she kind of like gave her the strength to actually just like, you know, walk down that street for the first time in years. I was like, this is good stuff. But also Cassian still just a scumbum who's just in it for himself and wants to go off to space Florida.
Space Miami, basically.
Yeah.
I think a couple cool things to just pull out of what you said there, Patrick. One is that this idea that Marva is inspired by the Aldani heist, but that, smartest thing Cassian did, not tell Marva that he did the Aldani heist, because that would have been risky information for her to know. So I'm glad he didn't be like, that was me that did that. So like, smart job, Cassian. Like, we get the sense that Cassian is kind of an F up in the show. And I'm glad that, you know, like from the early episodes, everyone's like, oh, Cassian, he comes in, he makes a mess of things. And like, that's the kind of guy he is. And so I'm glad he did not further that reputation by like telling her that he did it. But there is this idea of people can be inspired by things that weren't meant to be inspiring, right? And that is a fact in real life as well. And you think back to like, you know, all the times in human history when like something has happened either by happenstance or because of mercenaries that have nonetheless created a lot of change or inspired people. It's not the most common way that happens, but I just think it's interesting that the show is acknowledging it does sometimes play out like that. So anyway, that's interesting. And then the other point is, that the show is trying to say, there is no staying out of it in a fascist regime. Like you might think you are staying out of it, but like you are taking a side by default. And also you can still suffer under it. And we see that with Clem, and we also see that with Cassian himself in this episode. So, okay. Shall we talk about Space Miami?
Can we please? Because
and we should say Andor leaves and he's like, I will be back. So he does vow to come back and see Marva again. And I could see there being like one final scene with them, you know, because we know Cassian's going to become a leader in the rebellion and maybe that will allow him and Marva to reconcile, or Marva will hopefully join his side or something, you know. But
also, since Dedra Miro is now in charge of overseeing Ferrix, wouldn't surprise me if she goes to Ferrix and maybe ends up questioning Marva and Bix about what happened there.
Yeah,
I could see that happening.
All right. So we go to a brand new location, Niamos. And I was like, what is going on here as I was watching this? Like, where is this? What are we doing? Who are we even following? Are these all new characters? What are your thoughts, Patrick, on the location?
When the movie cut to, and did anyone say the name of the planet? Is it Niamos or Niamos?
Yeah. Not Niamos.
Niamos. Yes. Okay. When they cut to this like aerial shot along the coastline where there's like palm trees and stuff, and it's like, oh, this is Space Miami. And then Nicholas Britell's music is just like full like synth banger in a way that I don't think we've ever heard anything like that in a Star Wars score. Please tell me in the comments why I'm incorrect. And I was just like, this is the last thing I ever expected them to cut to. This is like, what a cool, fun new planet. I love to see this. I mean, this is just basically like a vacation town. This is, I guess, you know, the oh my god, I'm forget, what's the name of the casino world on Last Jedi?
Oh,
we were supposed to know this stuff.
Cantobite.
Cantobite. So the super rich people go to Cantobite for vacation. The, like, you know, the working class people, they go to Niamos. And also on a thing that I thought was, again, felt like new territory for Star Wars, was then we cut to like what seems like a hotel room where Cassian has just like had like a one night stand with a woman he probably met in a bar. And I'm just like, so the idea of like people having sex in Star Wars still seems like so foreign. It's like, mm-hmm. that like doesn't exist in other movies, even if mm-hmm. like people have children. And I'm just like, you know, people don't like go to bars and get drunk and hook up with other people. This isn't like, that doesn't happen in Star Wars. But yeah, but she's in bed and he's got the shower running and is like going through like his money and the stuff, like basically his share of the heist money.
Yeah. He has a new identity. Keith Giergo is his new name.
Good name.
And he has been sent out on a errand to buy Pizos and Revnog, the greeny green ones. Make sure you get the Pizos and Revnog, the greeny green ones. I have Googled this, and apparently these are new foods in the Star Wars. Like, it's not like well-known foods what they were, so... but there is a holographic ad that says "Tasty Pizos," featured on a building in Coruscant. So
I love this.
Some nice world building there. But anyway, he goes out and he sees people running away from stormtroopers, and then so he gets nervous and he starts running too. But then they mistake him for one of the enemies. They drag him away, and then we see an old friend show up, but he's not a friend at this point in time, right, Patrick?
Yes. It's probably not specifically K2SO, but like maybe a like K2 series droid. I don't. Right. Sorry that I don't know the exact model name. Right.
But it's the same type of droid as K2SO in Rogue One.
Basically. Exactly. And right. This is a thing where as soon as we see the droid for a second, I've so been enjoying the lack of like Easter eggs and tie-ins in this show, I've been like, oh, is this now going to be the story of how Cassian met K2SO? No, it's not. They just made a lot of those droids. And this one grabs him by the neck and slams him against a wall. And then he goes before a judge. And because of the like, I guess the harsher punishments because the Empire is cracking down on all lawbreakers caused by the heist that Cassian was a part of, he gets sentenced to 6 years in prison. Like, he would have gotten a 6-month sentence if he had not been a part of the heist in the last episode, which is the irony of this is honestly pretty funny.
Wait, what do you mean if he had not been part of the heist? What do you mean by that?
Well, okay, if he had not, I should rephrase that. If he had not pulled that heist in the last episode, like, it's because of that heist.
That there's so much more, like, intense security.
The judge says that, like, this normally would be a 6-month sentence.
Right.
But now, because of these new, like, decrees from higher up, this is now a 6-year sentence.
Right, right.
Also, and
he just barely missed the cutoff. So
I mean, it's like this sucks so much, but it is like kind of comedic that he just tries to get away and go to like a vacation place, and literally
he just wants his greeny green Revnogs.
He literally does nothing wrong. He committed the biggest crime in the galaxy, and now just by like walking and looking suspicious, he gets sentenced to 6 years in jail.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, again, also. Again, a perfect illustration of just, you know, the kind of world they're living in with under imperial rule. This is why people hate the Empire.
Yeah. And I did get a lot of Brazil flashbacks watching this scene. It's very interesting. I'm impressed they like built a whole new set or used a whole new location just for this courtroom scene.
Yep.
Where like they could have done it in like a nondescript room, but they like just did a whole kind of courtroom scene where it's like very Brazil, like where they're processing all these people, Judge Dredd style, like judge, jury, executioner, just like handing out sentences left and right. It's very Brazil-esque, and it's really what happens when you can combine like fascism and like a horribly non-transparent or opaque bureaucracy, yeah. pretty much. Like this nightmarish situation that like is impossible to escape from, basically, that's completely devoid of any humanity whatsoever. I really kind of appreciated that glimpse of that world.
Oh, yeah.
But here's the most important thing, Patrick, that's revealed in this episode, is we find out that pistachios exist in the Star Wars universe. Because that's what that woman who is running the judge, you know, the sentencing stuff, she's like eating pistachios and they're getting on the console, if I recall correctly. Did you see that?
Yep.
Yeah. So,
but are they called pistachios there?
Unclear. Unclear. For now, I'll just call them space pistachios.
But there you go.
Anyway, Andor gets sentenced to 6 years in jail. So, dude, do you think the rest of season one and season two are going to happen in jail? And we're just following Andor in jail? What do you think?
Yeah, and he has a lot of free time on his hands. And so he finally reads
Nemec's Manifesto
over and over again until he knows it by heart. I mean, my guess is that the next arc will, a chunk of it will be Cassian in jail.
Really? Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Which, you know, a turn I never expected this show to take, but I'm excited to find out, you know, where this is all leading. I never know what to expect week to week on Andor.
I think Vel's going to try to assassinate him, but in doing so, she's going to have to break him out of jail, or she's going to have to get to the jail, and then they're going to have an interaction where he convinces her to break him out. In exchange for maybe joining the rebellion. That's kind of where I think this is heading.
I mean,
so I'm putting my guess out there.
The thing that I think is very clear about this show is, and I'm sure was part of Tony Gilroy's whole pitch for it, is that joining up with the rebellion and like dedicating your life to this higher cause is not as simple as, oh, you meet one person, have a nice conversation, or like you see the Empire do one bad thing, go like, you know what? I've got to fight back against that. It is a person needs a lot of events and a lot of incidents in their life to steer them in that to radicalize them. Radicalization mm-hmm. is not as simple as like talking to Nemec, or even as simple as oh,
right.
reading his book and being like, you know what? He's right. Time to give up all my other goals in life and like, you know, and pledge everything toward this. It's complicated. And I think that's why it's taking a while for Cassian to get there, because we have seen all these reasons why he doesn't want to do that. Why joining up with a rebellion kind of goes against how he's been living his life this entire time.
Indeed. Well, we will see where Cassian's journey takes him. But I agree. It's interesting. He's basically a side character in the show at this point, and also hasn't changed very much in the last seven episodes. So I am curious like where they're going to take this character, who is the namesake of the show. But I'm equally as invested in all the other plot lines right now. So I'm still very much enjoying this.
Oh, yeah.
So, all right. That's going to do it for us here on Decoding TV. You can find more episodes of this podcast at podcast.decodingtv.com. Email us at decodingtv@gmail.com. And find us on TikTok, Twitter, and YouTube at Decoding TV. That is going to do it for us. We'll see you next week for another recap of Andor. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
And don't forget to tell us your names for the Dead Ramiro Cyril Karn ship that we're all very invested in. Thank you.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great, too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.